The United States is considered to be the homeland of democracy in the modern world. But ignorance about the foundations, the essential characteristics, and the prospects of democracy are probably more widespread in this country than in any other. For this reason, I felt it would be valuable if I presented to you a full-scale review of democracy's history in the Western world. We'll begin today where democracy began, among the Greeks. Where did democracy come from? Through what stages has it passed? What are its essential features? What are its prospects? I'll try to answer these questions in these talks by tracing the evolution of democracy through its main stages in civilized society from the Greeks to the 20th century. That's about 2,500 years. Naturally, I can only touch the high spots. Political democracy, like every other social institution, is a child of time. It was once non-existent. After its preconditions were created in the womb of class society, it came to birth among the Greeks and Romans of the first millennium before Christ. It was then stamped out in antiquity, and urban democracy found a new nest in the medieval communes, or urban centers of Western Europe. The national democratic state we're familiar with was established in the Western world through the popular revolutions against feudalism, which marked the accession of bourgeois forces to power. It matured in its parliamentary form during the 19th century. Most Americans who preen themselves as progressive, and outside of the Goldwaterites, most Americans do, have a very conservative outlook on democracy. It's really remarkable. They believe that its prevailing form in this country, which was established at the end of the 18th century, which as modern history goes is quite a long time, provides the universal standard of good government and stands at the summit of political achievement. They fail to see that democracy is far from having attained its full expression and perfected shape, and is, in fact, destined to undergo its most profound transformation in this epoch of the transition from capitalism to socialism. Democracy under the rule of the rich, and that's what we have in this country, has ineradicable limitations. I'm going to touch on them specifically in my last talk, so I can't go into them now. I can only come to the conclusion that these can be removed only by abolishing the social and economic inequalities bound up with capitalist property relations. The establishment of democratic government under the control of the working people is the political goal of the socialist movements which are shaping the history of our time. With this in view, let's now go back into the abysm of time. In its widest sense, democracy is as old as human society. The pre-literate tribesman who lived and worked together with his kinfolk was subjected to nature, but not to other men. In fact, the constraints under which we chafe and suffer would be intolerable to a person who lived before civilization or class society. Couldn't understand how people would bear it. He was the equal of anyone else. He or she didn't bow down before any external authority, and could not be compelled to act against his will or his welfare. The decisions of the clan or the tribe were made by all adult members of the community or their chosen spokesman, and enforced only by custom or general consent. Among the Indians, for example, whether or not to go on the warpath was decided by vote. And anybody that didn't want to go didn't have to go. They didn't have such an institution known as conscription. That's a civilized institution. And one, by the way, we never had in this country until I was a grown person. In fact, my parents came to this country to escape it. My father blew off his finger so he wouldn't have to be conscripted into the European army. This primitive democracy became eroded by the inequalities of wealth, the first social differentiations and group privileges that followed the development of agriculture, stock raising, craftsmanship, and the temple towns. Barbarian society, I talked about that in my earlier talk this weekend, saw the emergence of rudimentary aristocratic elements, chieftains, kings, nobles, priests, well-to-do traders, slaveholders, and their families. But many of the equalitarian ways of the original collectivism and its kinship system persisted. The warrior chiefs of the Achaean Greeks, celebrated in the Homeric poems, the early Romans, the Germanic tribes, the North American Indians, or the peoples in Africa, could not go against the councils of the elders and the assemblies of the people, which retain final powers of decision on important matters. However, these relations and customs of pre-civilized times are not connected by direct line of descent with present-day democracy. The continuity of social development was broken by the rise of the state, or as we familiarly term it, the government. The state is an apparatus for opposing the will of a dominant class with distinctive interests upon the rest of the population. And political democracy is a form of state rule. That's the first thing to know about it. And the state is a product of the cleavage of society into opposing classes. Rich, poor, owners, non-owners. The modes of democratic functioning, characteristic of pre-class society, which mankind lived in up to about 8,000 years ago or less, the modes of democratic functioning, characteristic of those times, were not based upon relations between rulers and ruled. Indeed, the Indian tribal structures which held North America before the coming of the white man had to be extirpated in order to clear the ground for the democracy of our class stratified society based upon private property. And the reasons the white man had to get rid of the red was not because of the difference in skin color. Was the difference in their forms of property, private property against tribal property, the rich against those who didn't know the distinction between the rich and the poor, those who had a state and those who didn't know anything about a state. Democracy, then, is a special type of government, representing the sovereignty of one sector of society over another through the mechanism of the territorial state. And the Greeks, who saw democracy bloom for the first time amongst themselves, recognized this very clearly. Democracy was first defined by Aristotle, the greatest mind of antiquity, the Karl Marx of the ancient times. Aristotle defined it as the supremacy of the many over the few. According to the theorists of constitutional law, it requires the submission of the minority to the mandate of the majority expressed through representative bodies. Since its birth, political democracy has not been a stable or permanent form of government. I might say that that in America has been one of the longest lasting in all history. It has been the exception rather than the rule in the history of class society. The division of the population into antagonistic and contending class formations is more conducive to the consolidation of aristocratic than of democratic regimes. And when the Goldwaterites talk about our having a republican rather than a democratic form of government, they're tending towards a restitution of the old aristocratic forms and elitist type of government. Thus, under civilization, democracy was preceded by other modes of rulership and has many times been overthrown and displaced by more exclusive types of political organization. Now, if I were giving you a course in political science, I would itemize these narrower types of government for you, through which small minorities dominate the majority. But I'll only list them for you. They include theocracy, rule by a priesthood, monarchy, rule by a royal family or a dynasty, aristocracy, rule by an elite, usually of landed proprietors, plutocracy, ruled by the rich, which can be of two kinds, either open and direct, as in some cities of ancient Greece or medieval Italy, or from behind the scenes, as in the countries of monopoly capitalism like our own today. Autocracy, one-man rule. And military dictatorship, ruled by an omnipotent commander are the officers' corps of the armed forces. Any one of these can coalesce with or give way to another. They can even be present, as we shall see, as an element within the formal framework of a democracy. Anarchy is another form of political state, the absence of all rulership. However, it can exist under class society only for a fleeting moment at critical turning points in the revolutionary transfer of power from one group to another, when one state apparatus has been pulverized and its successor has not yet been set up. And such anarchic episodes are quite common in the development of great revolutions, but they're very short-lived, especially in modern times when you've got to have a centralized force of some kind, either popular or autocratic, in order to govern. Democracy as a distinct form of state sovereignty is not much more than 2,500 years old. Although popular assemblies existed in Sumeria and possibly in other Mesopotamian civilizations, they weren't predominant. They may have been the survivals of pre-civilized rites and institutions, rather than the political conquests of plebeian masses in direct struggle with the upper classes. We don't know too much about these older civilizations. Some of them were unknown 100 years ago, and they're only being excavated and deciphered. But one thing we do know: the sole form of sovereignty in the regimes of the ancient Near East that we're familiar with, Assyria, Babylonia, Egypt, Persia, was the absolute monarchy, usually of a special type called theocracy, tied in with priesthoods and landed aristocrats. These were headed by god kings, who embodied the fusion of the royal family with a priestly caste. Such theocracies have survived in Asia down to our own day, in the Dalai Lama of Tibet, who had his comeuppance only recently, as you will remember. As a matter of fact, there are two of them now, both in exile. The Japanese sun god emperor and the divine ruler of Nepal. These are relics of the sort of government which held sway over the civilizations of the Middle East before the Greeks. The sacred monarchy was not an accident. It was a political necessity under the conditions. It was the political crown of a particular stage of historical, economic, and social evolution based upon the intensive agriculture of the Bronze Age in the river valleys of the Nile, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Indus, the Oxus, the Yangtze, and the Yellow River. Their irrigation systems had to be installed and managed by a centralized authority which concentrated all power in its hands. And this centralized economic power led to a parallel centralization and concentration of political power in the form of the theocratic monarchy. Now, what were they like? The kings, priests, soldiers, landlords, tax gatherers, traders, financiers, and craftsmen in these kingdoms lived upon the surpluses produced by the peasant cultivators of the soil. These had low living standards and few rights. The recurrent round of agriculture dominated their existence. The handicraftsmen didn't produce for a broad external market, but mostly for the needs of their own local communities, and especially for the upper classes. Merchants and manufacturers were comparatively uninfluential, since trade was restricted largely to articles of luxury and weapons of war. The weakness of the merchant forces and the utter dependence of the peasant population were politically expressed in the unmitigated despotisms of that period. The prostration of the subject before the almighty godlike potentate, which you have seen, the salams in the eastern kingdoms, was the manifest sign of this oriental absolutism. And wherever it is reproduced, whether in religious organizations or political ones, this is a reversion to that archaic form of political organization of extreme despotism and popular submission. Although the kingdoms of the Middle East rose and fell over several thousands of years, they remained remarkably stable in their political constitutions. Why? Because their economic and social substructures remained essentially unchanged. Through all the disturbances which shook up and effaced these ancient empires for thousands of years, monarchy as an submitted to a foreign rule at one time, and then it would have subject nations at another. But other types of rulership never dislodged or replaced the monarchy. And do you know something? Think about it. People of high and low estate then accepted kingship as the normal and exclusive form of political life, just as today's Americans look upon democracy. Why, how else could people live? Of course you gotta have a godlike monarch. Doesn't everybody? Everywhere? At all times? But the question wasn't even raised. It was beyond people's ken. Even the Hebrew tribes, for those of you familiar with the Bible, came to the divine kingship under Saul and David after they had just been nomadic shepherds. Now, we come to something quite different by the name of democracy, which was a colossal novelty in the world, much like socialism is today. It first appeared in the Western world in the 7th century in Greece. The Greeks created many things we value today. Not least among them was democracy. The Greeks not only had a word for it, they had the things itself. In addition to organizing the first democratic republics, they also made the first scientific study of politics. If you want to be a politician in a scientific sense and know something about the history of politics, you got to go to school with the Greeks, because they really knew something about it. They baptized democracy as rule of the people and gave enduring names to many other forms of government, from theocracy to plutocracy. Virtually every form of government that we talk about was named by the Greeks. They knew them. As a matter of fact, they were far more familiar with different varieties of government than we Americans are today. It's no accident that political theory was born and flourished among the Greeks. Their society went through profound transformations and convulsions as it evolved from the Homeric Age around 1200 BC to Alexander the Great in the 3rd century BC. The changes in the economic conditions and class relations of the Greek city-states were reflected in the establishment of a wide variety of regimes, many more than we contemporary Americans are familiar with, as I've said. Aristotle, the foremost investigator of political phenomena among the Greeks, collected and compared the constitutions of 158 different states. He had a group of researchers going out and collecting all this material. His Politics is the most instructive handbook of this branch of social science in antiquity, and every serious socialist should study it sometime. However much the Greek states differed amongst themselves, they differed even more from the kind of government known in Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, and Persia. The theocratic monarchy on the Oriental pattern was never solidly rooted in Greek soil. The royal palace was the center of the cities of the East, even of the Minoans and the Mycenaeans who preceded the Greeks. It was not to be found among the later Greeks, even when they still had kings. The political evolution of the Greek people started out where that of the Middle East had stopped. Although Greek civilization began with the monarchy, it withered or was uprooted very early. The Greeks went on to a more advanced development, which I want to tell you about. From the 9th to the 5th centuries BC, and I'll leave off the BC, you'll know I'm talking before Christ. They passed through a sequence of political structures, proceeding from kingship through aristocracy, oligarchy, and tyranny, to the Democratic Republic. Only the wealthy merchant city-states, from Miletus to Athens, completed the full cycle from monarchy to democracy. And even after these had climbed up to the democratic heights, the hold of the people on supreme power was very precarious. With sharp shifts in the fortunes and class relations of the state, democracy would be toppled over and the city revert to an anti-democratic form of rule. The Democratic Republic had the longest run in Athens, where it lasted for almost two centuries, with only two interregnums of oligarchic rule in 411 and 401. These successive advances and relapses in the political life of the Greeks were brought about by deep underlying changes in the economic circumstances, military structures, or rather social structures, and military fortunes of the different city-states. As you know, Greece was not a single nation and with a single government. It was made up of a multitude, 100 or more, of small city-states. The kings who emerged from the warrior chiefs and military aristocrats of the barbarian Bronze Age formed the political bridge between barbarism and civilization. They were challenged and displaced by the heads of the leading families, enriched by piracy, land ownership, grazing, slaveholding, and other means of wealth accumulation. These privileged and powerful aristocrats, patriarchal masters of extensive households, possessors of large flocks and fields tilled by peasants or slaves, owners of precious metals, not only deprived their fellow tribesmen of their ancient rights, but deposed the kings or restricted their functions. Their political mastery was based upon their military power as well as on their economic possessions, since they provided their own arms, armor, horses, and retinues for expeditions of war and plunder. I've given you some historical generalizations of a sociological kind. Now let me give you a living case. You've all heard of Sparta. You know what it is to have been a Spartan. Well, what was Sparta like? Sparta was the classic home of a militarized aristocracy in Greece. Under their kings, the Spartan invaders had conquered the native inhabitants of Lacedaemonia and reduced them to servitude. Subsequently, the landholding oligarchy, through reforms attributed to a legendary figure named Lycurgus, broke up the old kinship organization and cinched its political mastery over Sparta. This master class lived on the produce of the fields allotted to them, which were tilled by helots, the conquered slaves. No doubt you're familiar with the term helot as an equivalent of slave. Between the upper and the lower orders were what were called the periossi, or people who dwelt in the neighborhood. They lived in villages, or engaged in petty manufacturing, but they didn't have any citizenship rights. They were eight times as many, no, there were eight times more helots and four times more dwellers around than members of the ruling class. So you can see the kind of hierarchy that there was in the social structure of Sparta. It was a permanent agricultural military encampment. And it's very interesting to analyze it from that standpoint. It's one of these classic types in which you see things in its purest, its naked form. the Spartiates were forbidden to engage in trade or industry. The use or importation of gold and silver was prohibited, and only iron was used for currency. Foreign trade and visitors were discouraged. As a result, there were no cities in Sparta. Sparta retained two kings, but these had become largely figureheads. Their powers were reduced to performing the sacrifices of the state religion, heading the judicial setup, and commanding the army in war. They were subordinated to the Senate or Council of Elders, composed of men over 60. That's also a particular form of rule called gerontocracy, but we won't go into that. An assembly composed of all male citizens over 30 met monthly and was in theory the sovereign power, though it merely ratified by acclamation the recommendations of the elders. The administration was handled by four overseers who, after the Persian Wars, became the equals and then the superiors of the kings and could demote or punish them. Under this military despotism of Sparta, the repressive features of the state were exhibited without disguise and exercised without restraint. The army and police ruled by naked force. Every year, the Senate passed an official declaration of war between the Spartiates and the Helots. And this gave its officers legal right to spy upon and slay any Helot at their discretion. Now, such a state of war exists in South Africa and in other places. Only the master class doesn't bother to declare it every year. But in Sparta, they had less restraint, or they felt less need for disguise. To forestall revolt, the masters had the practice of periodically killing off the outstanding helots, just as the counter-revolutionaries today strike at the heads of all revolutionary movements, as they did with Lumumba and with others. Sparta's political constitution went back to the barbarian past. It retained the kingship, the council of elders, the assembly of warriors, and the age groups. Its entire development, however, was arrested by the conservatism of its ruling class. Although its government went one step beyond the monarchy, and in that step it registered an advance over the Oriental pattern, it never passed beyond the boundaries of aristocracy and autocracy. Now let's go on to the next and a higher stage of development in Greek civilization. We come now to Athens. The more progressive states outstripped Sparta in political development. Why? How? By promoting extensively the economic activities of commerce, craftsmanship, and of colonizing. It's interesting to note that the difference between Sparta and Athens was produced by the fact that in Sparta, these economic activities were stunted or prohibited, and in Athens and Corinth and in other places, they were encouraged and promoted. From the 7th century on, the seaport towns of the Greeks flourished like the maritime centers of colonial North America, and with some of the same revolutionary results. And if you want to understand what ancient Greece was like, study the history of colonial America. There were a great many resemblances between the two, although, of course, one was on a much higher level of development than the other. And I have often found that by comparing our own colonial life with that of the ancient Greeks, that many interesting correspondences can be found. The influences of the new social forces crowding the commercial cities, merchants, manufacturers, bankers, ship owners, maritime workers, artisans, shopkeepers, foreigners, and chattel slaves, transformed the life and culture of the Greeks. The new money economy also invaded the countryside and overturned the old conditions by enriching landlords and moneylenders while ruining and dispossessing the small farmers. During the 7th and 6th centuries, the growth of population and trade, the development of production for exchange, the broad circulation of money, the building of the towns, the rise of the mercantile classes, and the impoverishment of the peasantry engendered severe class conflicts and political upheavals all the way from Miletus in Asia Minor to Athens on mainland Greece. And this had political consequences and repercussions. In one commercial center after another, the new merchant plutocracy assailed the political monopoly of the old nobility, who had drawn their privileges from birth and blood, and their power and wealth from landed property. In most places, the moneyed men succeeded in overturning the ancient ruling family cliques and setting up an oligarchy or a plutocracy like that of the merchant princes of Venice of the Middle Ages and the Hanseatic cities in Germany. In other cases, and at a subsequent stage of development, a more complex situation occurred. In order to beat down the old aristocracy, the new rich had to call upon the plebeian forces in the city or countryside for sympathy and support. These poorer classes were artisans, maritime workers, foreigners, peasants, and shepherds. They fought the nobles, raised their own demands, and in extreme cases, reached out for power on their own account. In the course of these struggles, strong men came forward out of the upper classes, who placed themselves at the head of the popular forces and seized power in the city-states by maneuvering between the plebeians, the merchants, and the nobles. These ambitious and wealthy individuals centralized all power in their hands. They gave certain reforms and concessions, but no say in the government to the masses who had lifted them into the saddle. These dictators became sovereign by force, not by custom or by law. They have indelibly impressed their title upon the vocabulary of politics. They were called tyrants or demagogues, flatterers of the people. You're familiar with both tyrants, but even more familiar with demagogues. That's one thing that America produces in unlimited abundance. Now, every tyrant began as a demagogue, a flatterer of the people. But not every demagogue ended up as a tyrant. That took good fortune in the struggles. The rule of these men, and I say men advisedly, they were all male, since women took no part in Greek politics. The rule of these men was dictatorial, but it was not necessarily or essentially reactionary. We must beware of this easy identification between dictatorship and reaction. They pushed through democratic reforms enfranchised aliens, divided up the land, canceled debts, helped the poor peasants. They promoted manufacturing and trading enterprises and colonization. They spent much of their own wealth and that of their regimes in public works. However, despite brilliant and progressive achievements in a number of the leading city-states, the tyrannies were inherently insecure and short-lived. They were caught and ultimately crushed between two extreme combinations of forces: the aristocrats and oligarchs to their right, and the mercantile elements leagued with the movements of the lower classes to their left. The ambivalent historical role of the tyranny in Greek history has been excellently summarized by an English Marxist, George Thompson, in his book Aeschylus and Athens, which I quote from. The function of the Greek tyranny was transitional. By forcing and holding a breach in the rule of the aristocracy, it enabled the middle class to consolidate its forces for the final stage in the democratic revolution, which involved the overthrow of the tyranny itself. That is why in Greek tradition it was almost unanimously condemned, and why tyrant has come down to the present day as an opprobrious epithet. It was denounced in advance by the aristocrats because it was progressive, and in retrospect by the democrats because it has become reactionary. The dialectical development of history showed itself in the fact that democracy was preceded and prepared for in Greece by its very opposite, the autocracy of the tyrant. The tyrants, who balance themselves between the upper and the middle classes, set the stage for the next act in the political progress of the Greeks, the coming of political democracy. There was a comparable development, giving historical analogies, at the end of the Middle Ages in Western Europe, when the absolute monarchy balanced itself between the feudal barons and the town bourgeoisie, exhausted its usefulness after creating the centralized national state, and then had to give way to ascending bourgeois democracy. Now, what about the fortunes of democracy in Greece? Greek history witnessed the rise and fall of numerous democracies. In every case, and this is extremely important, I hope you'll remember it. In every case, these democracies were instituted by revolutionary forces and methods, just as they had to be overthrown by counter-revolutionary violence. Let's take Athens for an example. The first democratic victory there in 508 was the outcome of a three-cornered fight for supremacy in which the democratic forces led by Cleisthenes won out because their opponents were divided. Not one of the Greek city-states was democratized by peaceful and gradual means. Not one of all the scores of them. Now, how could they? Even your common sense would tell you that they could not. How could the rule of the people have been voted into existence when the institutions and laws of a democratic republic had yet to be created? You had to fight with arms in hand in order to get the right to vote. Well, you might say, possibly there were benevolent and far-seeing rulers who handed down democracy to the people. Well, this, if it's not said in jest, is a very sad misunderstanding about the nature of social classes and of history up to this point. None of the democratic institutions in Greece were handed down to a grateful body of citizens as a gift from benevolent rulers or enlightened upper classes. Democracy was the offspring of revolution. That was true in Greece, and that was true in the United States. It came to the Greek states, as it did later to other parts of the world, only through strenuous and prolonged class conflicts, which culminated in the destruction of more restricted regimes. This is not simply a theory, it's a fact.